Okay. Is that too loud? Are we okay? You know, this is a subject, I think it is a little too loud. Marco?
You're fine. It's not bad.
Okay. If it's fine, we'll go on. My voice tends to trail off a little bit, so I didn't want to overpower you or be too quiet. York College is a special place to many of us. We have several staff members here today. We also, some of us went to school here. I went to school here back in 1900, none of your business. It was a two-year school then, and went on to another institution, and have came back and worked at York for a few years in admissions, financial aid, and then went on to other places. Spent probably 4 years in higher education before Marie and I were able to come back to York College. And it's just been a blessing in our lives. Those of you who work with college students understand there's nothing like being in this environment. It is sometimes troubling and trying. Our Dean of Students is here, and she can attest to that. But at the same time, what we do here is just it's just phenomenal, because the future of our churches lies in the hands of a lot of the students who go to places like this. I just want to say a couple words, once again, to welcome you to campus. On this back ledge back here, I have two pieces of information. One is our semi-annual magazine that we put out that we'll have a lot of information about. We are now celebrating our 125th anniversary. And also, there's just a sheet with some facts on it. So feel free to grab one of those if you'd like to after the session. York is a little bit unique. We're a school of 400 students. Our highest enrollment ever was about 500. We have four nationally ranked athletic teams. We are very, very good at what we do, and what we do is get engaged in the lives of our students. Everybody knows everybody here. That's who we are. Smallness is kind of our claim to fame, and it's what we do best. We are also, 70% of our students come from outside the state of Nebraska, so we are not necessarily a Nebraska school. And we have the largest ethnic minority percentage of any school in the state. 30% of our students are ethnic minorities. So I think University of Nebraska is 8%. So, you know, that tells you a little bit about the inclusion on this campus and the outreach that we have. I won't give you any more of an advertisement for York College, but I just wanted you to hear a few things about us. We'd love to have you on our campus. We'd love for you to find out more about us. We think we have something pretty special here, and we really endeavor to make that happen. Our mission on the back wall, mission of York College, is to transform lives. Christ-centered education equips students for lifelong service to God, family, and society. The transformation in the first part of that mission is not just students. It's all of us who work here, too. We're engaged in the process of transformation. And as you know, it never stops. It's continual. It's something that we work on all the time. I believe this is going, so I think I'm ready to go. Thank you, Terry. I've been through a couple of sessions today that I hope would help me out. I just went to John Biggs' session, and I hope he was going to explain to me how to overcome memory loss. He didn't get into that. I guess that's another topic. But I've been so impressed by John Clayton. Every time I hear him, that man has such an amazing grasp of the facts, and he remembers them all. Mm-hmm. You know, and then when he starts quoting the Bible, I don't know that I've ever seen him open one. But, you know, when I go and check him out, he's right spot on. And, you know, I'm having trouble with even the mnemonics that I used to use to remember stuff. You know, like that one, the 12 apostles. Jesus called them one by one. Peter, Andrew, James, and John. Philip and Bartholomew. And then he called six other Jews. And I struggle all the time with memory. One of my favorite stories, and since you're a new crowd, I can tell it to you because everybody else has heard it, is a story of a young preacher back in the early 1800s, before there were Christian colleges, and he wanted to become a preacher. So what you did is you apprenticed yourself to an older minister. And you followed him around, and you picked up his mannerisms, some of his lessons. You learned how to preach from him. You know, it was very intensive training. And this young man attached himself to this old preacher, and they're traveling by horseback through West Texas one time, and they came to this small little congregation. And if you've ever been to West Texas, I lived there for 20 years. You know, it's hot and it's dry. So they're in this little town. It's 110 degrees outside. The church windows are open, but no one's there's not a breath of air. No air conditioning, no nothing like that. And so, of course, the men start dropping off first, and then the ladies start going too. And the old preacher is up in the pulpit, and he's watching all this happen, and he looks out there, and he kind of waits for an opportune moment, and he stops speaking. And the women start nudging their husbands, and you hear a lot of people clearing their throats as, you know, they're kind of waking up and stuff. And when he gets everybody kind of half awake, he makes this statement. He says, "You know, some of the best years of my life spent in the arms of another man's wife." Everybody's awake at this point. They're all sitting on the edge of the pews. They're looking at him. They're intently engrossed in his message. And when he has everybody's attention, he says, "Yes, sir, some of the best years of my life were spent in the arms of my mother, my father's wife." And he goes on with his lesson. Well, this young preacher, he's over there taking notes, and he just loves this. He's scribbling this down. He says, "I can hardly wait." Sure enough, years later, you know, he's out preaching, small West Texas town, same thing, same setting, everybody's falling asleep, and he's just licking his chops. "Now's my chance." And so he gets quiet for a minute, and everybody starts waking up, and he makes the statement. He says, "You know, some of the best years of my life were spent in the arms of another man's wife." Now, those of you who are preachers know that every once in a while, especially when you're first doing this, you get these mental blocks, mm-hmm. and you can't really think of what your point was. So he's looking around at the audience, and through the sweat streaming down his face now are tears, because he can't remember what he's supposed to say. And so he looks out at this audience, and with tears in his eyes, he says, "And for the life of me, I don't remember who she was." Well, suffice it to say, you know, I have memory problems anyway, but I have been so impressed with what I've heard here and the grasp of things. And I'm going to have to tell you that I am not an intellectual giant like you've been listening to for the last day and a half. You know, I'm pretty much a practitioner and deal with college students a lot. And so what you're going to hear from me, I don't have a whole lot of theory. I have some observations. I have some things that I've read, some things that may be helpful. But it's not going to be anywhere near the quality of what you've heard so far from some of these men. There's a passage that's getting used a lot these days, 1 Chronicles chapter 12, and everybody seems to be keying in on the statement about Issachar. In fact, I saw one of the websites that was talked about here was Understanding of the Times. And in 1 Chronicles 12, what has happened, David has been ruling for 7 years, but he's been ruling for 7 years, and Abner has been a puppet, has had puppet descendants of Saul on the throne, and there's kind of this conflict going on. David doesn't just take over the kingdom. It's a period of time. For 7 years, there's this conflict in Israel. And then finally, in 1 Chronicles 12, all 12 tribes come together at Ziklag and proclaim David as king. So this process is coming to an end, but it's not universal. There's still a lot of people who aren't sure they want David as king, who are opposed to him being the ruler. And so you have this list in 1 Chronicles 12 of all the people who come, and chapter 12, verses 1 through 22, it lists all the valiant men who were in charge of getting David to where he was. In other words, this is the honor roll of David's kingdom. Mm-hmm. Starting in chapter 12, verse 23, then each tribe comes forward and pronounces their allegiance to David. There's 339,000 people at this meeting. Now, that sounds like a lot, but that's probably not 5% of the people of Israel at this time. It's not a very large showing, and it's mostly the leaders. And Issachar, it says, they defer their honor to their leaders. It says those they defer to those who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do, to hundreds chiefs and all their kindred under their command. So in Issachar, it's just the leaders who come forward. And the intent of this, and by the way, I've seen this verse many, many times in talking about millennials, and it's always taken out of context, but the good thing is there isn't much context there anyway, so it's hard to figure out exactly what it meant. But evidently, these leaders of Issachar are so trusted by the people that follow them that they say, whatever you guys decide, we'll go with. Because we think you have a grasp on what's happening in Israel, what's happening in the world, and what's best for us. And so I think today we're in a similar spot to kind of understand the times. Now, these are some interesting demographics, and I'm not sure who all is included in Church of Christ. I'm not sure if that's just Church of Christ or if it has ICOC in there. It depends on who did the census and got the numbers. But you can see that there was some growth up until about 2001, and then the numbers started declining again, to where in 2010, the census has 1 million, 1.5 million members of the Churches of Christ in the United States. Now, that would have originally, and a lot of people are crying, you know, we're in deep trouble because of those numbers, but look at the next two categories. You know, didn't we start out with the Restoration Movement by saying, we're just going to be non-denominational Christians? Look at that next one, 194,000 in 1990. And in 2008, see that number? 8 million. Look at the next one. People who'd say, I just want to be called a Christian. I don't want a brand. 1990 was 8 million. 2008, 16 million. I think what we're seeing is more of a shift away from brand loyalty to people who want to identify themselves just with Christ. Is that bad? I mean, that's, I think, where we started this whole process, was trying to get closer to the gospel message and understanding Jesus. We know on our applications for admission, we ask people for their church home or their church background. We can't really tell where they went to church anymore because they'll put Christian down, because that's how they want to be identified. And so it's only through conversation we learn that they've gone to the Church of Christ or the Baptist Church or the Catholic Church or whatever, because they're really getting away from this idea of being identified with a brand. Now, that is not something that's new with millennials, but is certainly more prevalent with this generation than it has been with any generation previous. And you're going to see that trend continue. I think you'll see a lot of churches, at least in our fellowship, are just calling themselves the church. And it's kind of interesting, you know, in the New Testament, the name that's used most for Christians is followers of the way. You know, Church of Christ is only mentioned 3 times in the New Testament. I got into an argument, a discussion with a man one time who said, who used the old argument, if you're going to use, you're going to need to call biblical things by biblical names. And I said, well, we might as well be Church of God, because it's mentioned 43 times in the New Testament. We took Church of Christ because it differentiated us from another group. And so I think some of our efforts to identify ourselves, I don't want to say they've been disingenuous, but they don't make sense to this generation. Why did you pick this name instead of that name? And for most of us, it's hard for us to come up with a reason, because we really weren't there when the decisions were made. So I'm worried that somewhere we're between these two extremes. We're between nostalgia, which is wishing things were the way they used to be. I used to have a saying, still have it, I don't use it as much. Things aren't as good as they used to be. But then again, they never were. You know, there's some of us who want to go back to a simpler time. I mean, if you live in America right now, I hear people all the time saying, oh, I wish we were back in the 70s. I wish we were back in the 90s. I wish we were back. You know, they want to skip the 60s, though. They want to go, you know, a generation either side of that. But the other side is amnesia. I see this, I preached for a couple of years. And it was interesting to watch this play out in the congregation. Because one of our older members said, you know, we need a wall in the church building that has pictures of the people who got us where we are. You know, those stalwarts of faith who built this church and made it exist and supported it in its early years and went through the fights and all those kind of things. And so we got together and said, yeah, we'll call this the Great Wall of Witnesses, and we'll put their pictures up there, a little bit about them. And the youth minister came through and said, why do you want a wall with pictures of a bunch of dead people on it? And I thought, right there is the difference between these generations. Those who want to kind of go back and honor the past, maybe not live in it, but certainly cling to it. And those who want to forget the past. And neither one of those is the right answer, I don't believe. And I think we're facing that with this generation. We live you know, mythical land where all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the children are above average. Where do we get that?
Lake Wobegon.
I think we all know that. If you don't, you haven't listened to NPR, which is my staple when I'm driving.
Yeah.
But I think this last one is really describing the society that we're living in. You know, we live in a society where kids are rewarded for everything. There are no losers anymore. You know, even in athletic contests. Mm-hmm. I used to referee soccer, and I loved doing those under six games. You know, where there's six kids on each team, and they're just following the ball around the field. I remember one time we didn't keep score, but if we had kept score, the score would have been like 15-12, and two of those goals were scored in the right basket, the right goal. Because, you know, they see a goal, they see the ball, and they kick it. But everybody got a trophy. You know, there are no winners and losers anymore. Everybody is a participant. And so nobody has to, I don't want to say this wrong, but I'm going to, nobody really has to struggle to get to the top. Our kids don't know failure, and they don't know defeat. And those are character building. I was going to make another statement, but I don't go there because it'll get me in trouble. So what about today's students? Now, the millennials are the most studied generation in the history of our world. And they resent it. They hate it. The reason is there's more information out there. And it's like anything else, if you say, here's some characteristics of these people, well, that doesn't describe me. It doesn't describe you. It describes a generation. And some of these things are true probably across the board. Probably more of them are in specific situations. But here's who they are. They don't need adults for information. You know, they don't, from the age of probably, I don't know, 7 or 8, they start having cell phones, personal devices, and they don't need to come ask mom and dad anything anymore. They can go on the internet, or even worse, they can ask their friends and get the right information. I'm always amazed by what kids think they know in college, because of the Twitter feed out there. And, you know, something happens to a student on our campus, it immediately goes out to every student on our campus. And what other Catherine has done to them, according to their view, is exactly what the truth is. And that puts us as college administrators in a very awkward place, because there really isn't any privacy anymore. There is from our end, because we can't talk about anything. But from the student's end, They build up this idea of what's going on and the fairness of the world they're living in and how they're treated. And, of course, all of us know that he whose ox has been gored is in a much different place than the guy who owns the ox.
Yep.
So, you know, this causes some dynamics on a campus that are pretty interesting and pretty hard to deal with. They broadcast every thought or emotion. How many of you have heard of Laura Tesnolodik? Catherine has. She was a student here. That's why you haven't heard of her. She works at the local bank now, but she was a volleyball player for us. She transferred from another school because she played against us in volleyball and was so impressed that our entire student body showed up for a volleyball game and nobody at her school showed up, that she decided to transfer here. She posted on Facebook, and I wrote this down because I thought this, to me, epitomizes what's going on in this generation. She said, "I don't believe something awesome really happened to me until I post it on Facebook." Do you hear what that's saying? Their reality is tied up not just in their experience, but how that experience is first of all expressed and then perceived by other people. And you've all seen this. How are all of you on Facebook or Twitter or, yeah? So don't you see some of the most banal things you've ever experienced? And it's not like, let's sort through and find something important to put that everybody ought to hear. It's, you know, my cat threw up on the carpet today. You know, like, who cares? But it's those kind of messages, you know, that are all over, And so, you know, I see my wife at night while I'm watching Turner Classic Movies, and she's scrolling through all these pictures. About every 18 pages, she'll find one she wants to read. But most of it is just not worth spending time on. And so, you know, back in the 70s, no, 80s, I guess, Nesbitt wrote a book called Megatrends. And the first number one trend that he's talking about then was the overload of information. And how in the world do you manage the information that comes across your desk, that comes across your phone, that comes across your, you know, and it's interesting to me that even in church, we're back to using scrolls again.
Yeah. Literally.
Yeah. Scroll down to Acts chapter 4. You know, we have just so inundated ourselves with the technology, and we're to the point, folks. I don't know how we could get along without it. I mean, I said to Gail, my assistant, the other day, do you remember using an IBM Selectric typewriter and a copy machine? How in the world did we get any work done? Because now everything's email, it's instantaneous, and most of you in here are with me. The millennial generation are what we call digital natives. They grew up in this environment. They know the language. I'm going to show you some of that language in a minute, which is kind of interesting. But they grew up in this environment. They know how to navigate it, and that's why we always want to have a student worker in our office so they can come and show me how to use my computer when something goes wrong. Because I really don't want to know. But they know. My youngest granddaughter, when she was 3 years old, I went to visit my kids, and I walked in the door, and she said, Grandpa, can I see your phone? And I handed her my phone, and she hits like 4 keys and starts playing games on it. I didn't know I had games on my phone. These kids grow up with this stuff, and it's all where they are, and I'll talk about that more in a minute. Well, they're addicted to external stimuli. Now this one, I think I'll talk about it here. They're addicted to external stimuli, and this has a couple of interesting sidelines. I was talking with Dan Conger on the way back from the airport, because as I was listening to NPR on the way out there, they've been doing studies, and they said that the creativity scores on the college entrance exams are they're plummeting down. They're not just lower, they're plummeting down. And this will get to where John lives. And they said, what's happening is there's no time, except when you're sleeping, when you don't have external stimuli in your brain. They said, boredom is actually good for you, because that's when all the synapses start working. And maybe a problem you had a month ago. Oh, I just talked about Dan and Ewoks. I'm going to use your quote right now.
Okay.
All the synapses that start working, and they're solving problems that you really aren't thinking about, but that you've entered into your brain, and that's why sometimes you wake up at 3 in the morning and say, aha, I've got the answer. I don't listen to the radio anymore unless I'm getting real tired and have to have some stimulus, or unless NPR News is on. The rest of the time, I turn the radio off, and I spend windshield time talking to God and thinking, and my staff hates it. Because I'll start sending messages home, or I'll come home with a notebook, you know, full of ideas that I want us to look at. Kids today are not giving themselves the time to allow that stimulation to work in their brains. And so what's happening is creativity, imagination, it is going away. So Dan, attribute this quote to Dan Conger. As we were talking about this on the way out here, he said, so boredom is the mother of invention. We used to say necessity is the father of invention. But I think that's exactly right. Boredom helps us to settle our minds. That's why meditation has always been important to a human being. So the external stimuli. Now, what's also interesting about this is that this external stimuli comes in a lot of different forms. It's not just auditory, it's not just visual, but it's activity. I mean, look at what people are doing today for fun, for activity. But the interesting thing about it is they're addicted to external stimuli. They're addicted to adventure. Everything's got to be a little more exciting than the last thing they did.
Yeah.
But
but it can't have any risk.
Did you hear that? How many of you, and now some of the younger ones probably, grew up riding bikes without elbow pads, knee pads, and helmets?
Yes.
But that's what kids do these days. And everything they do has protection around them to keep them from getting harmed by what happens to them, even by making bad decisions. And so they want a lot of external stimuli, but they don't want the risk involved. That's where video games are taking these kids. You know, you can go out, I really have to disagree with people who say that they've studied it and violent video games have no impact on a student's or on a kid's actions out there in the world. There has to be a correlation. I mean, you go through and kill 30 people on a war game, it kind of inures you to those kind of consequences. And so I really think this idea of external stimuli, they've got to have constant action, constant movement, constant noise, and it's lowering their creativity, their imagination, and it's also making them live in an unrealistic world, because once again, they have faced failure, they have faced the significant struggles of having things go wrong. They have to have social contact at all times. I mean, when we hire admissions counselors, one of my board members said, well, you need some more admissions counselors who are older who will stay around longer. You need to hire some 30s and 40-something. I said, if you can't text at 2 in the morning, you can't be an admissions counselor. I mean, two nights ago, 2:30 in the morning, a group of high school kids walked by my house. I mean, they're not doing anything bad. They're just out doing stuff. And the activity in their lives is constant, and it has nothing to do with a schedule. Has nothing to do with, you know, even at work sometimes. You know, I probably was going to stay somewhere else, but one of the most interesting things that I have seen about this generation is 1 in 8 millennials. Listen to this carefully. 1 in 8 millennials will take a parent with them on their first job interview.
What?
Now, can you imagine that? And if you're someone who's actually interviewing for that job, interviewing that job for that person, what that says to you, we have that happen here. I can tell you the first week of orientation, because there are some parents who will not leave. They want to make sure their kid fits in. They want to make sure that they get all the right activities, they get in the right classes, they get the right books, so they hang around for a week to make sure that happens. And at the end of the week, invariably, I don't think they're going to be happy here. We're just going to take them home with us. And it's the parents who can't give up on the kids. And so they're growing up in these environments that are unrealistic and are protected. Parental protection. Once again, I'm not sure I plan on talking about this here, but you've heard about helicopter parents?
Yeah.
You know, and they are now the easy ones to deal with. It's the Velcro parents.
Velcro, wow, that's good.
That we struggled with. We had a girl in the dorm last semester who we finally had to say, hey, your grandmother has been here for 3 weeks. This is more than a visit. She is now living in our freshman dorm, and she is not allowed to stay there anymore.
She's paying enrollment.
Huh?
She's paying enrollment.
Seriously, though.
Three.
Living in the dorm?
Yeah, she was living with her granddaughter in the dorm. This is where this society is taking us. I'm going to throw this in here. It doesn't fit here, but I want to throw it in here because the lack of commitment that a lot of these people have because of the way they've been raised, and I'll say it now, and I'll probably say it again, because parents kind of bail them out of everything, is killing our marriages. And I have surmised that it probably wouldn't be too long before we saw a limited marriage contract. 3 years ago, in Mexico, the Mexican legislature considered and voted down a 2-year marriage contract. Now, the implications of that are, and this is where society is going, is I can sign a contract with you for 2 years. We'll live together, we'll be married, and then we can split, no harm, no foul. And we can go on to another relationship. I don't want to scare you. That's where our society is headed. And I thought it was something way in the future. But as I said, Mexico considered it 3 years ago, voted it down. But I guarantee you there's a country out there one of the more liberal countries that is going to start looking at marriage contracts rather than marriage for life. And that will change our society just like marijuana is changing for a lot of our society. This one's interesting, and you know, I think, Richard, you can probably relate to this one. Being in a class and teaching, and a student saying, I think you're wrong about that. You know, I'm the teacher. How could I be wrong? Well, I just looked it up, and, you know, that happened in 1873, not 1872.
Boy.
And so what's happening is students, because of their access, they don't have wisdom, but they have more information, and therefore the ability to get more knowledge than any generation previously. And remember the first one? They really don't need adults. They don't think they need adults. They do need adults for teaching them the right direction, how to look at things, how to sort through the information. Because right now, you know what the number one source of news for millennials is? What?
Twitter, Facebook, or
YouTube's the number one source of news information for millennials. They aren't going to waste time on television. Why?
It's scheduled.
It's scheduled and there's commercials. They live in a world where they can just get rid of commercials. They don't have to waste time, and they don't trust anybody in a commercial because they're trying to sell you something. And so, you know, when you look at all the stimuli that they're getting from all the different directions, they don't have time for commercials. They don't have time to engage in anything except what they're interested in, but they have access to and I need to say on number four, we all know this. You know, I'll go down to the cafeteria down here. I try to eat lunch there most days when I'm in town. And you'll see four kids at a table, and they're all texting at the same time. Chances are two of them are texting each other.
No doubt.
You know, they're sitting across the table from each other. But they don't have the ability. And they can say faster with their thumbs than I can speak. You know, that's amazing. Adults, basically parents, have enabled them to become extremely self-centered. I had a mother, I love using this example, but I had a mother probably 3 years ago call me and said, my son doesn't have a mattress in his dorm room. And I said, oh, has he talked to his RA? No. Has he talked to the dorm supervisor? I said, he shouldn't have to. I'm calling you. So, of course, I said, well, I'll get right onto that man and make sure he has a mattress by tonight, which I did. But I thought, the poor guy, you know, how do you say to mother? Well, tell him to take care of his own business. He needs to grow up. You can't say that in our world. Yeah. But that's what mom and dad should say. In fact, that's I talk to the parents every year as we start school, and I say, you're going to get the call. And the call is going to come sometime in the first few weeks of school when, well, you've been there before, right? You know, I remember one time I said, you know, I was eating breakfast and I said, everybody at school hates me. My teachers don't like me. There's a couple of kids who want to beat me up. And I just don't want to go today. And my wife looked at me and said, you got to go. You're the president. But what happens now is kids complain to their parents. And, you know, when I was in school, the good old days, you know, nostalgia. If I wanted to talk to my parents, which was never, because if I talked to my parents, it meant either I needed money or something had gone on.
Right. Yep.
And so I had to get enough quarters to go down and get to the payphone and get through, and then I could only talk for so many minutes. And the average student talks to their girls, especially, talk to their moms 4 or 5 times a day now. It's just constant. And, you know, we try to tell parents, when you get that call that says, I can't stand it here, nobody likes me, your answer needs to be, you need to finish the semester. Because if they quit then, it will continue to happen.
Yes.
And these kids need to go through the fact that there's going to be struggles in life, and they need to live through them, and they need to know how to solve them, and they need to deal with them and go on and learn from that experience. But a lot of times, parents aren't enabling them to learn the lessons. And real honestly, if somebody's going to make a mistake, I'd much rather they make it here, where we've got people who love them and care for them,
yep,
than going to a state school and maybe getting in a lot of trouble, you know, because we're going to be there for them here. phone has become the rite of passage. Do you know that for the first time in our history, having a cell phone was more important than getting your driver's license? Wow. You know, all of us who are older can remember waiting till, you know, I was in Oklahoma, I had to be 14 then, I was 16 for my friends in Texas. But that was the day, you know, you couldn't wait to get your driver's license. Well, now it's a cell phone, but it's happening much earlier. It's happening sometimes at, well, you're getting mom's old phone or dad's old phone, maybe as young as 6 or 7, but certainly by the time you're 8. And we couch this in terms of it's a safety thing. Mm-hmm. We want you to have a way to get hold of us in case of any problem. And I don't know who all's bought that, but it's you know, that's not kids are using phones for. They're using them to run their lives. And the stuff they have access to on those phones is just mind-blowing. I don't have access to it because I don't know how to get to it. But they have access to stuff that I can't even imagine. And they do that at such a young age that it's just, you know, this goes with delayed adolescence. Adolescence now goes from 8 to about 23 or 24. You know, it used to be this little period of, you know, right toward high school. But now it starts younger, and it goes far into your life. I almost want to argue one of the statistics that keeps getting thrown at us, and that is that more students are moving back home with their parents because they owe so much to college.
Yeah.
Well, they are moving back home with their parents. Some of them may be doing it for financial reasons. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them are doing it because it's a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to live with mom and dad and use their resources till I accumulate enough to get out. And mom and dad, you know, that's happening. That's the way life is anyway. So it's not necessarily always a reaction to economic. I don't believe that. Because of the way this is happening, young people can avoid the consequences of their decisions. And, you know, I've already talked enough about it, that, I guess, to say it's just sad to me that people need to fail. They need to know how to fail and how to get through failure. You know, when you look at the New Testament, I've always thought it was kind of, I love teaching life of Christ. I remember once I was asked to teach life of Christ to the congregation. It took me 3.5 years to get through the Gospels, about as much time as Jesus lived, actually. And so when I teach a class in college and I have to teach 16 weeks, it's always tough for me. But you get into Paul's letter. Why does Paul write his letters?
Answer some kind of problem or fix some kind of issue.
There's always problems between people that have to be dealt with. If we didn't have problems, we wouldn't have the New Testament, basically.
Yep.
You know, and that's the reason. And so somehow trying to help young people not have problems. You know, once again, I'm going to say something I won't say.
I don't mind.
I think we've entered the new Gnosticism. I think kids are able to separate their spirituality from their physical actions. I would hesitate to guess how many young people have had intercourse before they come to college at York College. Christian kids from Christian homes in Christian settings who think that our ideas are antiquated and out of date because, after all, anything you watch, you know, even the home improvement shows that I like to watch, about half of them now are dating couples who are planning to get married someday. But they're buying a house and renovating it and getting ready to move in. And I was talking to some ladies one time and they were commiserating over some junior high girls that they'd had. And they were talking about some dating show on TV, which I admit I don't know anything about. And they said, well, how could they select each other? They haven't even been in a hot tub together yet. And I'm thinking, what's the perspective that young people are getting about sexuality, sexual relations, how you interact with each other, and the risky behavior? There's one of the probably the most significant books I've read in a while, here to Catherine a year or so ago. It's called Sex and the Soul by a lady named Meg Jay. She is a psychologist who's been studying sexual activity in college students. And, you know, it's very interesting because I'll probably get these wrong, but she divided college students up into four different quadrants. One was schools that had no affiliation, no state school, just kind of anything goes. Another one was colleges that had some sort of private interest, Harvard, Yale, something like that, that wouldn't see themselves necessarily as religious. Another was religious colleges that really didn't stay close to their roots. A lot of the Catholic schools fell in that. And then they had evangelical colleges, Christian colleges that really believed in Christian principles. And she said, I'm going to divide up into these four groups, and she started studying them to find out their sexual activity and their sexual mores on campus. And she said, by the time I got halfway through the study, I realized there was two groups, Christian colleges and everybody else. There was no difference that we found in the other schools. And she talked about the fact about how it's ruining our young women, and how, and she, I don't believe she has any kind of faith background or commitment, but they're talking about the casual sex that is expected now. And, you know, I mentioned in John's class, I wanted to make the point that I tried to make to our students that from 20 to 30, you're developing your frontal lobe. You're developing those synapses that have inhibition, that guide your judgment. And if you're doing all the stuff that you think ought to be done, and if you watch MTV at spring break, and you know what you're supposed to do at college, I mean, when kids come here and find out we're tobacco-free, we're alcohol-free, and that's not just on campus. You know, you can't drink if you're a student here. You know, they come here and they find that out. Some of them are really shocked by that because their picture of college is, this is where you go try everything. You got 4 years to get it out of your system, to sow your wild oats, do whatever you want, and then you can settle down. Well, the problem is you're developing habits and lifestyles that's going to be real hard to shake after 4 years. And that's why I think it's very, very important for places like this to exist, even though all of our students don't buy into it. It's amazing to me because, as I told you, our mission is to transform lives. That doesn't usually happen in the four-year period they're on our campus. Now, some of them, it does. I can give you example after example, and they're wonderful examples. But what is more telling is the people who go off and 5 or 6 years later get married and have their first kid, and they start thinking about, I don't want this kid to be raised like I was raised, but I remember those families, I remember those people at York College. And that's why 10% of this county now is either York College graduates or their relatives, because they want to move back to rural America. It's surprising how many California people we have to move back to rural America to raise their kid in a place that has values and some boundaries. Safe. Well, anyway, I think we're in the new Gnosticism because kids have separated their spirituality from their physical lives. And Meg Jay's book brings this out. 82% of the people she surveyed across all these four colleges describe themselves as spiritual. According to Gallup poll, 14% of students in college today have actually read the Bible. Now, what that means is there's a big gap between how you and I would describe spirituality, which is a commitment to God and Christ, and spirituality, which is talked about in the general vernacular today, which is, you know, I've got these emotive feelings, I have this sense of being more than just a physical body, but they don't know what to do with that. And so I think we're heading into a period, and I'm seeing this happen with our college kids that come from church homes, too, is the fact that, well, you know, I'm going to go to worship on Sunday, and I'm going to have this deep experience with God, but then I'm sleeping with my boyfriend on Monday night. I don't see anything wrong with that. You know, they haven't got a grounding in what it means to deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow Jesus. I hope we get to that. When is this supposed to be over? 2:45.
Okay.
Now, I got this from a guy named Tim Elmore, and this was very helpful to me. This is what millennials expect. I'm getting this way, too. If my computer takes more than 2 seconds to bring something up, I'm beating the keyboard, and, you know, I know you're not supposed to curse, but guess what my curse word is? Because Gail will tell you. if I'm ever frustrated, she'll hear him say, Google.
Google.
That's good. So speed is essence, and they're not going to wait around for anything. But aren't we all getting that way?
Yes.
I mean, we want instant information, instant gratification. Convenience. If I can't get it in one click on Amazon, forget it. I'm certainly not going to get in the car and go to the store. You know, and by the time we get out of this, you know, online purchasing is already taking over the world. By the end of this next generation, it's going to be hard to have anything stay open except Starbucks. You know, because we get internet there.
Mm-hmm.
Entertainment. This goes, once again, they need to be constantly entertained. There needs to be constant stimulus in their life. Where they get bored, and once again, boredom is the mother of invention. They need nurture. Now, this is interesting. They're socially isolated from each other, but they really need nurture. And I'm going to come back to this at the end because this is where I think we really can make a difference as Christians in the lives of millennials. I think this is where we reach out to them. And they're entitled. Boy, we're seeing that more and more and more.
How come you give me an F?
Yeah, well, Terry said, but I was an A student in high school. How could I get a C? Well, you didn't turn this paper, you didn't show up half the time.
Yeah.
But I'm an A student. Yeah, but you still didn't do. But I'm an A student.
Yeah.
So that ought to just follow me through college too, right? And, you know, that's one of the toughest things they have to learn. It's also... Okay, here are things that you are going to avoid if you're a millennial. Hard is bad. If it's hard, I'm going to go on to something else. You know, it's just, I don't need to waste time with it. It's going to take a lot of time. It's hard to get through. Boring is bad. Once again, boring probably is better than we think it is. Slow is bad. Risk is bad. Work is bad. You know, it's interesting. You may have seen around campus there are a bunch of guys on mowers and the weed eaters. And it's interesting when we hire that summer crew every year, how long it takes to teach them how to work. Because a lot of them have never had to have jobs before. Now, here's another one of my favorite stories. It has nothing to do with this lesson, but it's about the old guy who, you know, after retired, realized he didn't have enough money to get to retirement, so he decided he's going to have to go back to work. And so he's going through the job interview process. And this young guy who's interviewing finally asks this question. He says, well, tell me what you think your greatest weakness is. And the old man looks at him and said, I'm honest. And the young man says, I don't see how that could be a weakness. And he looks at him and says, I really don't care what you think. Okay, now some of you will get all of these. This is a test. Tell me what these are. We'll start with the first one.
Tomorrow.
Pretty easy.
Tonight.
Be there.
Be there before. You're all wrong.
Blah, blah, blah.
Before
you know it. That one's fairly easy.
Bacon, mayo, and... Oh, sorry.
Be right back. Can't talk now.
Because?
See you soon.
What?
Boy,
see
babe.
You soon.
I'm terrible at this.
Me too.
What's the next one?
Call the wild. Oh, wait, I know.
It's completely waste of time.
See you later.
Now, these are all cell phone text messages.
Right?
See you tomorrow.
Face to face.
Great.
Hack.
You're way too literal.
I don't care.
I don't know. In real life.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Just to let you know.
Some of you are pretty good at this.
Unless you're the younger set.
What you know, what you want to know. Oh, never mind, sorry. Kill me now. Fine, I'll do it.
Any guesses on the next one?
Later.
Oh, wait. keeping parents close. Now, you're going to see a couple of these, a couple more of these that ought to scare you.
Later.
Monday through Friday, by the way.
The force movies.
I like that one.
This shows up a lot.
Mind your own business.
North Carolina.
Never mind.
No problem, I got that one. Not that it matters.
On the phone.
Parent.
Parent alert, yeah. Parents are listening.
Yeah. Parents are watching.
Parents are watching.
Parents in the room.
Parents in the room. Yeah, if you start seeing those, you know, it's kind of interesting because they're developing this whole language. And it's, you know, I don't know if we're ever going to have a college class on this, but, you know, it's going to be interesting to be able to tell exactly what kids are talking about as these. Okay, I want to shift gears a little bit here at the end of this because I want to talk about what do we do with all this? You know, it's whenever I taught Bible, I always said, so what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do we do with this information? I want to encourage us to be aware. You know, I remember back even a decade ago where there were people railing against postmodernism. And, you know, I'd read that and I'd say, well, yeah, but that's the world we live in. So trying just to defeat it is probably not going to work because we're not going to change the entire culture. And aren't Christians always called to be countercultural?
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever the culture is, we need to be the ones that have the standards and the setting. And we really need to be showing people a different kind of life and not just arguing. And I've heard Dan was talking about this in his session. Rather than just hitting them in the face with the truth, it's, let me show you a better way. And is Christ the answer to every problem we have? If we believe that, why aren't we starting there instead of trying to defeat arguments? I have a couple of examples here. And I know they're probably not the best examples, but one of my favorite stories, as I said, I love teaching the life of Christ. I could just spend years doing that. John chapter 4, the woman at the well in Sychar, who I call the first feminist of the Bible. I hear a lot of people talking about her in a different vein, this poor woman, and I'm thinking, she's married five guys, she's living with a guy who's not her husband, she has to go out and get water somewhere else in the rest of the village,
yeah.
And she really doesn't care.
Yep.
She's her own woman. And Jesus walks up to this well, and they start having this conversation. I don't know exactly what he senses in her, but she says, hey, you're a Jew, and you're talking to me, I'm a woman, I'm a Samaritan, why are you doing that? And he said, well, I'm thirsty, I need a drink. All these cultural barriers just kind of go away. And they get into this, to me, intriguing conversation. As she starts talking about, you know, the water, and he says the living water, and she says, well, I'd like some of that. I wouldn't have come out of this stupid well all the time. He says, well, I can give it to you. And then he says, why don't you go tell your husband to come out here? And said, I'm not married. Well, you aren't married because you've been married five times. The guy you're living with now is not your husband. Do you see how the conversation takes a 180-degree turn right then? And she says, you're a prophet.
Yeah.
I have a religious, spiritual question that's been bugging me for. And all of a sudden, all this cultural stuff has just gone away because Jesus has connected with her at that level. And they have this deep conversation. And I would contend that Jesus probably has the most successful evangelistic encounter of his entire ministry right here. What miracles does he do in Sychar?
Nothing. Well, changed lives, but nothing.
I mean, he tells her about her past. She goes in and says, I've got a man who told me everything I ever did. Well, he did. But that's, so the people say, well, come tell us more. And they come out and question. And they turn to Jesus. And those poor lunk-headed disciples just don't get it. But Jesus is on cloud nine because he's just had the best day of his ministry. But it started out with this in the culture. Now, the other one that I like to mention just in passing. I'm not going to tell you what to do with this. I'm not going to give you any theological meaning to it. But when I was preaching one time in our congregation, it was kind of interesting. I wish we'd do this more often, but we had services in the morning and then Bible class at night and doubled our Bible class attendance. Because by 6 o'clock at night, you know, parents could get their kids up, they could get them fed. It wasn't, you know, so we'd have worship in the morning and Bible class at night. And in the morning I preached on worship. And I made some statement like, well, if you go to Africa and you tell the people there not to clap, they're going to think you're crazy. And some of my members at that church were way down that road already. And so I said, I had that conversation. Then that night, in Bible class, even before we started, a lady raised her hand. She said, well, how far is too far in worship? And I said, that's exactly the question. And I'm not sure we still have got our arms around that completely yet. But I think I had my only one moment of brilliance as a preacher. Because I said to that class, about 70 adults, I said, go home this week and study the synagogue in the Old Testament. And when we come back next week for class, I want to have a discussion of the synagogue in the Old Testament. Well, they came back a week later, and as usual, the two little ladies who actually do anything. You know, when I asked who studied this, they raised their hand. Well, tell me about the synagogue in the Old Testament. And one lady said, I couldn't find it. I said, really? You mean you went through the whole Old Testament, there's no mention of the synagogue? And she said, no. So I talked about the exilic period and how the Jews had to get 10 elders together, and the synagogues became their schools and their churches and their banks, and it became the center of the community. And I said, but isn't it interesting that Jesus, when he comes, doesn't spend 3 years saying, you guys are using a man-made institution to worship God, and it's wrong. What does he do? He goes to the synagogue and he preaches. Now, once again, I don't know how to tell you to deal with that theologically. I don't want to go there. But as I told that class, I said, the lines are probably not where we've drawn.
Yeah.
But I don't know that. I mean, but that's an example. My favorite example is probably Paul in Acts chapter 17. You know, he's been to Thessalonica. He's been to Berea. Both of those experiences turn out bad. He gets thrown out of town in both of them. And he comes to Athens. And as far as we know, there's no synagogue there because he doesn't start preaching to the Jews. But he walks downtown in the Areopagus.
Yep.
And he says he's distressed at all the idols he sees. And instead of getting up and saying, I'm a Jew and I want to tell you why you guys are wrong and you're going to hell. He says, I saw one of those idols to the unknown God. I mean, you guys know the story. I don't have to tell it to you. Let me tell you about that God that you're worshiping but you don't really understand. And he goes into this, you know, my favorite passage in Acts is Acts 17, where he says, and God laid out the times and seasons for him, and he put men where they're supposed to be, and actions happen when they're supposed to happen. God did this so that men would reach out for him and find him, even though he's not far from each one of us. And I marvel at that approach and how it uses culture. And I think as we're talking to millennials, the so what is, we need to find out where they're living and find out how to approach them in that context rather than trying to convince them. I've got a young lady who I performed her parents' marriage ceremony 35 years ago. 2 years ago, her father had an affair, divorced his wife, is now married to the woman he had the affair with. He had been a Bible thumping straight down the road, you know, do it this way guy. And last year, I got a call from the mom, and she said, Casey has become a Mormon. And she said, my dad has talked to her, and I've argued with her, and I don't know what to do. And I said, well, you're going to have a hard time, and you probably need to give her some space right now, because I said, the authority figure in her life has just told her that everything he ever said to her was a lie.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I said, when you got a divorce, the church didn't know what to do with you. You weren't in the couples group anymore. There wasn't really anybody to associate with, so they're kind of embarrassed what to do with you. They didn't know how to minister to you. And so the church kind of moved away from it. And I said, she saw that, and now here come all these Mormon young people inviting her and making her part of things. I said, she knows the truth. Give her time. Let her grow through this. And don't try to push her right now, because that will push her further into friendships. John, this comes from Francis Schaeffer, so some of you probably heard it before. He wrote this little book called The March of the Christian. Always been one of my favorites. And I'm going to talk about this one more than the others. But he says, you know, John's gospel, we all know, is phenomenal. It's very interpersonal. It really records about 7 days of Jesus' life, you know, in different ways. It's built around 7 miracles. And if you look at those, what you're seeing is John saying, here's how my journey of faith started in Cana of Galilee, the raising of Lazarus. He said, in between there, everything built on the faith. But he has these interactions, and 3 times Jesus makes this statement. To the Jews who believed on him, their statement like this. John 8:31-32, you all know him. Jesus said, if you hold my teaching, you're really my disciple. What's this word right here? First word?
Then.
What does that mean? After you do what I tell you to do, then you'll know what?
Truth.
You'll know it's right. And the truth will set you free. I didn't come to Christ. I was logically convinced of salvation, baptism, all those kind of things. I think one of our speakers has talked about that before. I came from a very logical position, a very reasoned position, to believe in Christ and believe in Jesus. This is where millennials are. You give me an experience that validates the importance of being a follower of Christ. And if we do that, they're eventually going to understand the truth. You know, I talk a lot about our young people don't know the Bible anymore. You know who starts knowing the Bible? It's people who have started a relationship with Christ and they want to find out more.
Yeah.
And I think maybe sometimes we're starting in the wrong place to get them convinced and to get them engaged. And I think this is so... I'll get to another slide that kind of talks about that. The second one, of course, is the granddaddy of them all. Jesus says in John 13:34-35, after washing the disciples, I'm going to give you a new commandment. Love one another as I love you. Love one another. By this, everyone will know what? You know, we have given, Schaeffer says this in his book, we have given carte blanche to anybody out there in the world. God has given them carte blanche to look at us, and whether we like it or not, because we say, well, you know, we're all hypocrites, we're all going to have bad days, we're all going to have problems. But God has given them the opportunity to look at the way we interact with each other and say, those aren't God's people. Because they don't get along with each other. They don't love each other. Now, that doesn't mean we always have to agree.
Right.
But it does mean that we have to show love for one another. And the last one, of course, in John 15:8, my Father's glory, you actually got to do something. Bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. Matthew 21:43, I think, is an interesting corollary to that, because he's talking to the Jews there. Jesus says, therefore I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people who will produce its fruit. You have centuries, and nothing has come. I'm going to give it to somebody, and that's us, who's going to bring it to fruition. Okay, these are some interesting observations. This was done this year by Barnum. They're probably doing more study, young people, than any other group. And it's kind of interesting. These are some dichotomies, because even though these people are socially isolated on a personal level, millennials really value community. Right here, is where we have the opportunity to really make an influence. When they come to church, the interesting thing is they aren't going to fill out a guest card. When you ask them their name, they're probably going to give you their first name. They won't tell you their last name. They're going to stay somewhat removed. But your reaction to them and how you engage them on a personal level. And this is a great ministry for some of your older members of your church who have a little time. Say, hey, today is your day. If one of these kids walks through the door, love them. And that is the number one thing that millennials are looking for. They're looking for some place where they can have a community. It's interesting that they want to call the place they worship the sanctuary, not the auditorium. Now, that gets into some theological terminology that we've used for years, at least, where we are. But they like the idea of the religious term of a sanctuary, a place you go to get away from the world. This one was interesting. They'd rather have classic worship than trendy worship. Now, the thing you hear out there is you got to jazz up the worship service to get the millennials in. Real honestly, they're going to be more connected with you by walking through the door and finding somebody who cares about them than whatever happens during the worship service. And so, you know, not that worshiping, that means you can make your worship as boring as you can, but that's not what they're looking for. They prefer quiet introspection. I don't know how they feel about the preacher telling them to turn off their cell phones, but, you know, if they do that and just worship and spend time with God, that's a meaningful experience to them. They'd rather have it casual, and I think most of our churches are pretty much in that direction now. And they'd rather have it modern. Now, we don't know what that exactly means, but I think we're talking about songs. You know, we have an interesting mix at East Hill sometimes. What's more interesting to me than the new songs that I don't know is some song that somebody has dredged out of the back of the songbook that I don't know anybody ever sang in teaching us that. But they really look for, if they hear something on the radio, you know, they'd like to hear, you know, Our God is an Awesome God, or, you know, the song we sang this morning, our kids sing that all the time. Now, I'm also going to quickly go through this. I put this slide in after talking with Dan on the way out here because I'm not sure we've really convinced ourselves as Christians and maybe some of our congregations that there is one answer. If you look at the fall in Genesis, there are four relationships that man fell out of relationship at that point. First one is with God. It's pretty easy. Second one is nature. You know, by the sweat of your brow, you're going to earn your bread. You're going to have pain, childbirth. Fellow man. I always joke about this, but I'd love to hear the conversation between Adam and Eve after Adam has told God, that woman you gave me, she gave me an apple in my head. You know, I just thought I'd like to be a fly on the wall that evening as they sort through that one. But the final one is man fell out of relationship with himself. I don't care how many therapists you go to, I don't care how many social agencies you put in effect, unless you solve this problem, you're never going to be able to solve the rest. You want peace on earth? Bring everybody to God. You want to solve your personal problems as far as your, you know, what's going on in your life, your emotions and everything else? Turn back to God. You want to be one with nature? Come to God. If we as Christians really believe that is the answer, then we need to start saying that. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. You believe it?
Yeah.
Then that needs to be what millennials hear. Now, I love this quote by Gordon MacDonald. I used it a lot. I forgot the age of MacDonald. What if we were placed on this earth to know Jesus and for no other reason? When it comes right down to it, isn't that right? Whatever else you're doing in your life, that's why you're here. This relationship with God, with Jesus. Luke chapter 4. I put this in after talking to Dan too because I couldn't quote it exactly yesterday. This is Jesus. He goes to the synagogue in Nazareth. He opens the scroll of Isaiah. And he says, the Spirit of the Lord is on me. He has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom to the prisoner, recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, and proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. That's why I'm here. I didn't come to cure all the social ills. I came to bring people to God, and that's going to solve the problems of this earth. I'm going to quickly just run through these and not spend any time on them. This is from the Barna Group again. These are how they have determined what people today, young people today, see as self-righteous and godly attitudes. Self-righteous attitudes, I find find it hard to be friends, friends with people who seem to constantly do the wrong things. It's not my responsibility to help people who won't help themselves. I feel grateful to be a Christian when I see other people's failures and flaws. I believe we should stand against those who are opposed to Christian values. People who follow God's rules are better than those who do not. Probably some truth in all of us. But this is what they see as being attitude like Jesus. I see God-given value in every person. Amen? Regardless of the past, regardless of the present, God is for everybody. I see God working in people's lives even when they're not following. That's interesting. It's more important to help people know God than for them to make sure they know their sinners. Wow. I feel compassion for people who are not following God and doing immoral things. That one really hits me where I live on this campus. And when a Bible major come in to see our provost, and he said, I don't like the way we're talking about gays and lesbians on this campus. And, you know, after the discussion, he went away, I think, feeling very much better. But the point was, we love the people, but we can't condone the lifestyle. The lifestyle is contrary to Scripture. Well, these kids are really struggling with that dichotomy and how to deal with that. We're not doing a good job. I tell others the most important thing in my life is following God's rules. I don't talk about my sins or struggles. That's between me and God. I try to avoid spending time with people who are openly gay or lesbian. I like to point out those who don't have the right theology or doctrine. I prefer to serve people within my church rather than those outside the church. Like Jesus, they would say, I listen to others to learn their story before I tell them about my faith. Conversational apologetics. In recent years, I've influenced multiple people to consider following Christ. Now, this one's kind of interesting to me because I used to be a grant officer for a private foundation. And one of my jobs was to go around and visit all the people, both who we gave grants to, those who wanted grants, and spend time with them. I talked more about God and Jesus with those people than I had in any other job I'd ever had. I did that for 5 years, and then the congregation where I worshiped asked me to be the preacher. And I became the preacher. I go back and see those same people. They wouldn't talk to me anymore. Because now, you know, I'm the preacher. And I think this is the place where, you know, we can really make a difference. And that is just our daily conversation with people. I regularly choose to have meals with people who have a very different faith or morals than me. You know, the woman taken in adultery comes to mind here. I try to discover the needs of non-Christians rather than waiting for them to come to me. And our kids are here, boy, they're doing service all over the world. I personally spend more time with non-believers to help them follow Jesus. So, you know, these people who are not branding themselves but are labeling themselves as Christians, this is where they're coming from. And I have to tell you, I admire them. I mean, I think our future, I don't know where our future is going to take us. But I think it's going to be different than it is now. And I think in some ways it's going to be exciting. It's going to be really messy. Mm-hmm. But I think following Jesus kind of always was.
Yeah.
So it is 2:45 and I'm done.
He's talking about the new Gnosticism. I know it's a different concept, but I've been calling it the new Dark Ages because we have so much information at our fingers, but we don't know how to.
Good.